to the final case this morning, Williams v. Airborne Express. Mr. Windham.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Danny Windham. I represent the appellant, Mr. Cornelius Williams, in this case. Your Honors, this is a Title VII case that was dismissed on summary judgment. Mr. Williams filed a complaint alleging race discrimination based on his termination from defendant's employment at Airborne Express, the defendant. The district court dismissed Mr. Williams' complaint or granted summary judgment for two reasons. One, the district court ruled that we failed to establish a prima facie case, and also the district court ruled that we failed to meet our burden to show pretext. With respect to the prima facie case, the district court said we did not identify a similarly situated person. Therefore, we fell under McDonnell Douglas. The problem that we have with that is that in making this ruling, the district court relied, in our view, totally on the evidence submitted by Airborne. It drew all inferences in Airborne's favor, and it didn't give us any benefit of any doubt or anything. For example, with respect to the similarly situated, the district court says, well, the plaintiff alleges that Kyle Henson is a person who's similarly situated. However, Mr. Henson was only terminated one time for gross insubordination. Mr. Williams had been terminated more than one time. Okay, so Mr. Williams had a worse employment record. Mr. Henson submitted the declaration. In his declaration, he says, I was terminated at least three times for gross insubordination, and each time I got to keep my job. The district court should have at least considered that that was a disputed fact. This was up on summary judgment. Actually, I think the district court should have looked at the evidence in the light most favorable to us and concluded that Mr. Henson's employment record was exactly the same or worse than Mr. Williams. He received more favorable treatment. He was similarly situated. As far as the plaintiff failing to meet his pretext burden, Airborne asserted three reasons for the termination. They said he didn't return his ID, his prior discipline record, and he committed gross insubordination. With respect to the prior discipline, since I think that's the easiest one, Airborne admits in this brief that its employees are governed, the terms and conditions of their employment are governed by a collective bargaining agreement. The language from the agreement is in the record, it's in my brief, and it simply says that if an employee is disciplined, that discipline cannot be considered if he has not been disciplined for the same incident within 9 months. The discipline that they rely on with respect to Mr. Williams all occurred prior to the 9 months before they terminated him. So they should not have considered that. In any event, even if they considered it, his disciplinary record was no worse than Kyle Henson's. They also said, well, he failed to return his ID, which we could see at the time he did not tender his ID to Mr. Stuyvesant. However, the evidence in the record, the declaration from the other employees, and from Mr. Williams is that Airborne does not require its employees to turn in their ID when they are terminated. Airborne relies on...
I thought he admitted that, though, when he was before the board on the investigation of the grievance.
You know, I think it's really kind of ambiguous whether he admitted it or not. He says... His statement was, I didn't feel like I had to turn it in. He says, they asked him a question, and they said, why didn't you turn in your ID? He said, I didn't feel like I had to turn it in. I think that could be interpreted in a number of ways. One way being, well, at that time, I didn't feel like I had to turn in my ID. You have to understand that Mr. Williams had been a union steward for 4 years, a chief union steward for 2 years. He represented employees in their termination matters. He knew from his experience that Airborne did not require employees to return in their IDs or their uniforms when they were terminated. And I will argue to this court that these days an employer will probably just void an ID or a security code in a matter of seconds when they terminate somebody. I don't think getting an ID is all that, getting an ID back is all that serious.
I thought he said something like, if you're so tough, come and take it or something.
He did say that. That was his dispute with Mr. Stuyvesant. However, Judge Cuddy raised what he said at the board, National Labor Relations Board.
No, but I'm talking about the incident itself.
The incident itself.
And he extended his arms and he screamed and he said, if you're so tough or you're so hard, come and take it.
That's true. He did do all of that. And that's where they get the gross, I believe that's where they get the gross insubordination from. The district court said he was belligerent and refused to return his ID. And judging whether or not that was a gross insubordination, Mr. Judge Evans, I'm asking you to look at a couple of things. One, look at Stuyvesant's conduct. Look at the way Stuyvesant approached Mr. Williams when he's in his uniform, he's completing a grievance against Mr. Stuyvesant. After Stuyvesant tells him, that's what you go do, okay, he leaves Stuyvesant on the dock. It's over with then. He goes into the office area. He and Pope, they're completing the grievance form. Stuyvesant approaches him in a threatening and hostile manner. Okay? We put that in our brief. Airborne has never spoke throughout this entire proceedings. Airborne has never spoke to Stuyvesant's conduct and the way he approached Mr. Williams. So, yes, he did say, extend his hand, says, come and take it. But he was only defending himself from Mr. Stuyvesant's conduct. Okay, Stuyvesant was hostile, aggressive, and belligerent in approaching Mr. Williams. That has not been denied. Nowhere has Airborne denied. They don't even mention it. When they talk about the conduct, they just said Stuyvesant approached him while he was completing the grievance form. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I make this point. The nature of the workplace is they do that all the time. They argue, they fight, they do that. Airborne's own manager, Mike Montgomery, said, look, I've seen arguments. People get terminated. They get brought back all the time. All of the witnesses testified that it was a hostile and adversarial relationship between union and management at Airborne. So his conduct, it was belligerent, but that was normal or in the workplace. It did not violate any established norm. Thank you.
Counsel. Ms. Ballmer.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Jody Ballmer, appearing on behalf of Defendant FLE Airborne Express. Defendant submits that the district court's decision granting its summary judgment should be affirmed for several reasons. So I just want to amplify on a few points in the brief. First of all, although the district court did not even address this issue, but defendant's position that it could have granted summary judgment based upon the undisputed facts that the court is sure well aware of and especially set forth in our in plaintiff's response to the undisputed facts, which is not mentioned anywhere in either of his appellate briefs. But the undisputed facts established that Mr. Williams was insubordinate to Mr. Stuyvesant. He refused to answer his questions. Mr. Williams does not deny that. He does not deny that he raised his voice. He does not deny that when he was terminated, he put his arms out to his side and said, if you're so hard, come and take it. He also doesn't deny that this conduct was so loud and disruptive that customers could hear about it, could hear the conduct. Excuse me. Larry Bates, another supervisor, wrote a statement about that. Plaintiff does not dispute any of those facts. Given that conduct, I think it's clear that Mr. Williams was not complying with defendant's legitimate expectations on January 14, 2003. Additionally, I think the undisputed facts confirm that the district court properly found that there was no issue of fact as to the issues of whether or not similarly situated employees that were not black were treated differently, or that there was any dispute as to whether or not Mr. Simpson's reasons for the termination were a pretext. With regard to the issues similarly situated employees. First of all, and we've cited a number of cases where I think each one of you honorable judges was on some of the panels in these cases, but for example, in the Crawford case, the Seventh Circuit pointed out that a plaintiff cannot cherry-pick comparables in connection with their prima facie case. And they have to show that people are comparable in all material respects that suggest that he or she was singled out for different treatment because of their race or other protected category. Plaintiff clearly has not done that in this case. First of all, plaintiff at his deposition had testified that he thought three white employees were treated better than him, who were union officials or union stewards. First of all, he named a gentleman by the name of John Caruso. Mr. Caruso, like Mr. Williams, was terminated. And like Mr. Williams, defendants established on summary judgment that Mr. Caruso was taken to the six-man board, which was primarily plaintiff's complaint and his deposition. It wasn't so much that he was terminated, but that he was taken to the six-man board. So Mr. Caruso, a white employee, was treated the same as Mr. Williams. Plaintiff also identified a gentleman by the name of Mark Postillion. Mr. Postillion was actually employed by the union during a strike, and because of certain conduct during that strike, Airborne attempted to terminate his employment from the inactive employment from the seniority list. Because Mr. Postillion was not actively employed at Airborne, they agreed to reinstate his status on the seniority list as part of the grievance process. Mr. Postillion is clearly not similarly situated to Mr. Williams. And then finally, what plaintiff referred to extensively was his complaint about Mr. Hankson. He claims that Mr. Hankson was treated better than him. He also claims that the district court, as we heard, he claims that the district court made a credibility determination as to the declaration. But clearly, the declaration, which is a matter of three or four lines, does not begin to establish a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not Mr. Simpson treated him differently. Mr. Simpson's affidavit establishes that he left that particular facility in March of 2002. Mr. Williams was terminated in March of 2003. Mr. Williams was terminated in January of 2003. At the time of Mr. Williams' termination, and Mr. Hankson's declaration does not dispute this, Mr. Hankson had been terminated one time for gross misconduct in 2002. And Mr. Hankson's declaration does not dispute the fact that Mr. Simpson viewed them as different between Mr. Williams and Mr. Simpson, Mr. Williams and Mr. Hankson, because it was Mr. Hankson's first offense. And unlike Mr. Williams, he had not had a history of misconduct, three prior terminations, two within the prior year even. So therefore, the declaration does not begin to establish an issue of fact as to that issue. Moreover, in this court's decisions in Adams v. Walmart and Bosley v. Rush, Judge Evans, I believe you were on both of those panels, the court made clear, as well as on other decisions we cited in our brief, that conclusory assertions that do not provide specifics as to whether or not the individuals are similarly situated with regard to employment history or with regard to conduct cannot create an issue of fact and does not support a prima facie burden. And in this case, nothing in Hankson's declaration indicates that he had a similar work history because no specifics are provided regarding what led to the alleged terminations, nor does it begin to state what dates the alleged terminations occurred. And in fact, I point out that Mr. Hankson's declaration was executed in November of 2006, and he said that he was a current employee, so it's difficult to tell what time frame he's referring to. And then finally, we submit that the district court clearly did not err, and it should be affirmed because there was no issue of material fact as to pretext. Mr. Simpson did an independent investigation when he got back into the office after he got all these calls during the incidents that we detailed in the brief and investigated. He interviewed the supervisors. He also interviewed non-management witnesses. Based upon his investigation, it was his good faith belief that Mr. Williams had engaged in gross insubordination and he had clearly refused to turn over his company ID on two separate occasions to both supervisors. He just wouldn't turn it over. Moreover, this was submitted to an independent six-man board. And this independent six-man board heard evidence from both the company and Mr. Williams' representatives, and Mr. Simpson advised the board that he did, in our statement of facts, it set forth that Mr. Simpson explained that he felt the termination should be upheld not only because of the conduct that Mr. Williams committed, but because of his prior history of misconduct and terminations. Now, Mr. Williams is claiming that he wasn't entitled to do so under the collective bargaining agreement. We detailed in our brief the discussion of cardinal sins and how it was applied, but the bottom line is, even if Mr. Simpson was mistaken in his belief that he could present that to the six-man board, the fact of the matter is that mistake is not pretext. It may have been a mistake, but the court has been very clear in many decisions that in the Seventh Circuit that a mistake is not pretext. So, and moreover, I think Judge Kinney in the Debsney v. Northeastern University case, a similar situation where there was an independent investigation done as well as an independent review board reviewing whether or not the termination was justified. And just as in this case, where the independent review and the investigation is done, there is simply no evidence of pretext in that sort of situation. And then I think there had been a question about what plaintiff had admitted in connection with the ID badge policy. Plaintiff is claiming, and his claim first arose during in his declaration. This was never raised during discovery, by the way. But plaintiff claimed in his declaration that the company did not have a policy requiring people to turn in their badge. First of all, obviously, the plaintiff cannot attest to what the company policy or practice is. Moreover, he admitted in response to statement of fact number 62 that he did understand that he was required to turn his identification badge in upon termination, but he didn't feel like doing so. He did not claim that there was simply no justification for asking that. And, in fact, it defies logic that a company could not ask somebody for their company property and ID badge when they terminate someone, especially when they engage in threatening behavior. And plaintiff does not dispute that Mr. Stuyvesant viewed his challenge to come and take it, to his ID, as a challenge to fight him. And plaintiff has not identified any individual who engaged in such behavior and was not terminated.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. How much time does Mr. Windham have? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Windham.
Thank you. With respect to the ID badge, Mr. Stuyvesant terminated Mr. Williams because Mr. Williams did not say, "My name is Cornelius Williams and I'm off the clock." Stuyvesant approached Williams in a manner discussed in our brief, which has not been denied or even addressed yet again. They say nothing about that. That counts for something, okay? So he approaches Mr. Williams and he, you know, leans over him, sees he's completing the grievance form, says, "Who are you?" Williams says, "You know who I am," which is legitimate. He had told him on the dot, "I'm the union steward. You're violating the agreement." Stuyvesant then says, "Okay, are you on or off the clock?" Williams, believing that he's engaging in union activity, says, "I don't have to answer to you." At that point, Stuyvesant terminates Williams. The idea is not even an issue. It is not even an issue until after the termination takes place. Okay? So that goes to pretext. Second, the Illinois Department of Human Rights conducted an investigation. It's in the record. Here's what the department says. Montgomery further stated that he approached claimant, Mr. Williams, and confirmed to him that Stuyvesant had terminated him and asked for a complaints identification card. Montgomery stated that complaint refused and requested that Montgomery call Regional Field Services Manager Mark Simpson. Williams says Montgomery went to go call Simpson to see if it was proper to ask for his ID. Montgomery never came back, so Williams left. Had Montgomery came back and said, Simpson says turn in your ID, Williams would have given it to him. However, at this point, that should be a question of fact. That should be decided before a jury, not here on summary judgment.
And this question of whether Syverson attacked Williams or Williams attacked Syverson, the matter went before this so-called independent board, and they held against Williams. Now, shouldn't we give some weight to their evaluation?
Absolutely.
They're right into the details of this whole thing.
Absolutely not. You should give it no weight at all because it went before a labor board dealing solely with whether or not there was a violation of the union agreement. We filed a claim based on race discrimination. Okay? We're saying that Airborne terminated him because of his weight, race. We're saying that Henson also committed several acts of gross insubordination. That's their label, not ours, okay? And they let him keep his job. The Labor Relations Board, when he brought up race at the Labor Relations Board, they said this is not the forum for that. So it was not even discussed there. There are two completely different issues between what's going on here and what happened at the six-man board.
Thank you, Mr. Windham.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.